This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
If I can just get people to understand that it's okay buying something that's used, it's okay trusting with other people that you can do it, and it's okay to use a currency that's not dollars to actually store value and get the things that you need. Those are three big kind of cultural changes that we need them to accept first.
How much junk do you own? You're probably not technically a hoarder, but like most Americans, you may have way more stuff than you know what to do with. Stuff that's no longer valuable to you, but that you just don't want to throw away. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk to Adam Werbach, the co-founder of Yertle, an online sharing platform that allows people to trade things they no longer need or want in exchange for other people's stuff that they do want, using a points-based economy. No currency changes hands, and no new materials are used to make more stuff. Then I speak to the author of The Ogallala Road, Julene Baer. Her touching new memoir is a personal account of how the ascendance of industrial farming in America has laid waste to the social fabric of the heartland. Joined now on Sea Change Radio by the co-founder of Yertle, Adam Werbach. Adam, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be with you.
First, why don't you tell us what Yertle is, and then I want to go back a little bit and talk about your pretty storied environmental and business career.
Sure. I mean, Yertle, Yerdle, is a store, a community where you give and get things for free. Pretty simple idea that there's no reason you should be buying something new when there's something great that's sitting in your garage, your friend's garages, so you can put something up on Yertle. It's an iOS, an Apple app, and a website, and people offer you credits for it. They earn those credits by posting items themselves, and they can get something great on Yertle without having to have anything new made, anything sort of pulled out from the earth and manufactured into something new.
And it's kind of a give and a get community, correct?
Yeah.
You gain credits for having good stuff that other people can then use, and you can use those credits to get other stuff that might be useful to you.
Yeah, exactly. So I just got a lunchbox for my son, and I paid about 40 credits for it, and I had those credits because I had posted some other things that people wanted.
Being the co-founder of the company, didn't give you any extra credits?
No, I don't get any. I don't unfortunately get that. Although I'm proud to say I'm one of the very active giver on it, because I've got three little kids, so that means that we have lots of things coming out of our house and lots of things that we need to get for our kids.
Sure, I know there's a little store not far from us and called Chloe's Closet. You may be familiar with it. It's the same kind of concept. You get credits for bringing old clothes from your kid's closet, and then you find stuff that might fit them better and as they grow out of their clothes.
Yeah, well, you put your finger right on it. I mean, the informal economy for durable goods, the types of things that we use, you know, in our homes, that type of things that our kids use, that we use to cook dinner or to get our house organized and set. Those have typically actually been handed from person to person. And it's only in the last 40 or 50 years that we've figured out that buying them is the best way to get them from each other. And it doesn't make any sense. It makes no sense whatsoever that it's easier and faster to get a coffee maker new from Amazon than finding one that's next door in a neighbor's garage that's perfectly serviceable.
How do you see in general the sharing economy transforming cultures to become more aligned with the values of the environmental movement?
So the sharing economy, or, you know, simply stated, the idea and effort to make more use of things that are sitting idle and to use culture and people to do it, is thriving right now, right? It's the beginning of another thing. It feels very familiar to me, and it feels very much like the beginning of the corporate sustainability movement at that time. And you see it in some big options like an Airbnb, where you see, you know, Airbnb is rapidly becoming the largest hotel operator in the world, and yet they have never built a hotel room. And similarly, I want to become one of the largest distributors of products and never make a product, and never have one cause one to be created. We can do that because right now we have so much stuff. I mean, Americans basically buy about $1 trillion of durable goods every year. These are the type of durable household goods, not things like cars and dishwashers.
Sometimes we forget the term durable when we buy those goods.
That's another challenge, that many of them aren't truly durable, right? They're accounted as such, and why they're called that is that they're accounted for as part of GDP.
They'll last a little while.
They'll last perhaps once. And one of the reasons why many things are sitting in our garages is because they're broken and they can't be refixed, and we'll get around to it. But honestly, we never will. Is once it breaks once, it's just garbage.
And that's not going to be useful in the Yertle model, is it? These broken goods.
So broken goods are a problem for us. And obviously there are people, we have lots of handy and thrifty people who can put things back together. So that happens sometimes, but we really have to fix that part upstream. So Yertle is a marketplace, right, where people put things up that they have that they're done with, and they earn a credit that they can then go get something else that they want with those credits.
They're not just lending it.
Yeah, there's no loaning on it. We actually started with loaning, but we found that it was a very small use case, that most people actually had just tons of things to give away.
Yeah, take my TV for the next month, but I want it back. That doesn't happen too much.
It doesn't happen, but I mean, it might on your block in your neighborhood, and then you don't need us for that. So go do that. You know, it's like we want people to do that behavior. And, you know, there should be lots and lots of different, just like there's lots of different stores, there should be lots of different sharing economy companies that you work with. And many of them are nonprofits. Your local library should be doing this. If you go to Berkeley, you can get tools and seeds and all sorts of things from the local library. Your local library should be doing a lot of that. The problem for us in terms of durability is that if it's something that doesn't actually work, then it's not going to get passed from person to person. One of the reasons we have a deep and long partnership with Patagonia is that they make things that are going to last forever. And if they break, they're going to repair them. So Patagonia has been giving away things that have been returned to them on Yertle. Warranty still exists. They're able to use them, and people get access to an item that they may not have been able to afford at the first time. They get to try it out, and it's great for Patagonia because they get to meet new people, they get to demonstrate the durability of their product, and they frankly get to inspire other product manufacturers to be the same. And we're going to put a lot of effort into working quietly with product manufacturers, and we're doing this work already, to make better things and to make sure that they get reused, because that's actually the holy grail, right? We have one small part to play, which is that once something gets sold, it's in our universe. You can sell it your first time, and we're going to make it so that it'll continue to move between person and person, continue to be enjoyed, and not sit idle in a garage, not sit idle in a closet.
So what's in it for Yertle besides helping change the planet? You're a for-profit company. Explain your business model, if you will.
Sure. I mean, we're a California benefit corporation, which means we're a purpose-driven company that is driven by a single mission. And our mission is to reduce the number of new things that people need to buy by 25%. So that's what guides us. We're funded by double bottom line or triple bottom line venture capital firms that are invested in the mission as well and get that. The way that Yertle will support itself is through the credits. We may sell a small amount of them, through partnerships with brands, as we can help them become better. We can profit from that. But you know, ultimately, what we're really focused on right now is building a liquid marketplace. So to give you a sense, you know, we were doing we probably did 1,000 transactions in January. So 1,000 items moved and not have to buy new, which felt okay. We'll do 1,000 transactions a day now. So 1,000 items moving between person and person.
That's in 5 months.
That's in, 5 months. I'm very proud of each of those items. That's just a jacket or a coffee maker or a thing that just never needs to get made. You know, the business I was in before was, how do you make that coffee maker have less packaging around it? Or how do you make sure it's just a little bit better or less toxic? Now I just don't even need to, I just leapfrog that. Now we're just not having another coffee maker, which is much, much more efficient.
How much of it is going to be shipped? That's obviously an issue with carbon footprint issues. And it would be great if it could be more of the Craigslist, where it's local and community giving and sharing, than the eBay model, where it's pretty cool from a business standpoint that you can share something with somebody in Indiana if you're in Florida. But from a carbon footprint standpoint, it'd be a lot better if you're in Indiana to find somebody else in Indiana who you could share that with. How is Yertle helping to address that?
From a carbon standpoint, reusing an item, I don't care if it's shipped or put it on a airplane and sent across the country. Honestly, it's most of the carbon footprint is actually in the production initially of the item, and then it's transportation to the United States.
So preventing buying new things right there solves that
and
problem.
And so if someone, if someone buys it from Yurtle through Yurtle, instead of buying it from Amazon.com, it's at least 100% better because, you know, you're still gonna have shipping if it's on Amazon or from Yurtle. But in this case, you've not had a new thing made. You don't have a new package, new box made. You don't have a new, it's the number of things it saves is significant. So about 75% of the items on Yurtle right now are being shipped from person to person. 25% are that way. I would love to see that number flipped, where 75% of the items are passed neighbor to neighbor and 25% are shipped. It's just going to take some time for us to get the kind of the selection up to that place. Because if you want a coffee maker, you really want a coffee maker. And if you want an espresso maker, you're not an espresso maker. And if you want a espresso maker made by a particular company, okay, you could want that too. Each of those things makes it harder to find that thing on your block. So right now, if I can just get people to understand that it's okay buying something that's used, it's okay trusting with other people that you can do it, and it's okay to use a currency that's not dollars to actually store value and get the things that you need. Those are three big kind of cultural changes that we need them to accept first. The good news is that it's pretty easy and it's working because it's free stuff. It's stuff you just don't need to buy. And so the downside risk of it not working out, worst comes worst, you're out a shipping
fee. Some credits and shipping fee.
Well, if you're paying $2 for shipping something, you know, you'll pay $2 and your credits. But the credits we give you, and you get 250 credits when you join. So that's enough to get a coffee maker. So it's probably enough to get two coffee makers. So there's very little downside risk for trying it out. And most people just are like, oh my God, this is amazing. I can get all the things I need and I don't need to spend any money on it.
Do you see the price points for Yurtle moving up and up as it becomes more of a liquid marketplace like you're hoping it to become?
Yeah, right now we're trying to control as much as we can for lower prices because what we're focused on is the kind of household everyday products. So we want to try to keep the community relatively with sort of a relative income equality across it. So we're growing so fast that, you know, there will be, you know, 5 months from now, more people in Yurtle than there are in Yurtle today. And in 5 months, again, there'll be the same thing. So we're just growing so fast that it's a first time user experience for most people in the community. So we want to keep it kind of priced very reasonably right now. So people feel like as they're first accumulating their credits, there's things available. As people get more credits, and honestly, the way you get credits is by posting more items. As you post more items and get it, then we'll kind of open up the options for things that are more expensive.
All right. So Adam, walk me through a typical transaction.
So people who've used eBay will be very familiar with many of the mechanisms on Yurtle. It's mostly an auction and a get it now transaction model. You post an item, it takes about 10 seconds to post something, and you can set up a price. So I could say this costs 25 credits, and if you want it for 25 credits, you say, yes, I want it. 25 credits are taken from your account. You have 250 to start, so you have plenty. And then if you can either pick it up for me, or if you're far away, you can pay $2 to get the thing shipped. And that the payment actually happens through Amazon Payments. And then the thing comes to you in the mail. Or you decide to pick it up. I put up a t-shirt and I put up that it cost 20 credits. And people paid 20 credits and took about 3 minutes for it to go from when I posted it. I could also have said, I said, I'll just do it by auction. So I said, I don't set a price. I don't know what it's worth. I'm not sure. And then in 4 days, I would either find out that someone got it and what they offered me, or the person with the highest offer, I would get that number of credits, it would get reposted if it didn't go.
And then if somebody received it and they weren't that pleased, could they just knock you down a few credits, or do they have to return it? How would that work for an unhappy customer?
Yeah, we actually have we're unlike most people in the informal marketplace, we actually have a high degree of customer service. We call it member happiness. So we offer, in that case, if I had sent you a blender and it didn't work, Yurtle would refund the difference. And then
Yurtle does.
Yeah, we take care of that for people, and we refund your shipping fees too, just to make you happy. And, you know, basically, if something gets broken in transit, those things, we take it up with the shipper and take care of it. If you're repeatedly sending things that are broken, we'll just kick you off the system. So it's a... it doesn't happen that much. There's some kind of accidental errors where someone packs something wrong and it gets broken, but pretty much people are awesome. Like the great thing about working with with a peer-to-peer marketplace is that people are generous and friendly and helpful and forgiving. And, you know, we keep on finding that, you know, every time there's something happened and people basically figure it out themselves.
He's the co-founder of Yertl, Adam Werbach. Adam, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Check it out at the App Store, Yerdle. Thanks.
Tune in next week on SeaChange Radio to listen to the second part of my discussion with Adam Werbach.
Now what would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Bend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. Lord, I'll try not to sing out of key. I get by with a little help from my friends. I'm gonna try with the help from my friends. I get high with the help from my good friends.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on SeaChange Radio by the author of The Ogallala Road, Julene Baer. Julene, welcome to SeaChange Radio.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
What was the inspiration for this memoir?
Well, I'm a literary writer. I like to tell stories. I have always been very closely identified with the land where I was raised in northwest Kansas, where my family had a wheat farm and sheep ranch in my childhood. And I had watched that farm go from these art and science of dry land agriculture to irrigating unsustainably out of the Ogallala Aquifer, and that troubled me a lot.
So water is one of the key themes throughout the book, and the Ogallala Aquifer is what a lot of SeaChange Radio listeners might be familiar with because we've profiled the Keystone XL pipeline quite a lot. Explain the not just the symbolism, but the reality of the aquifer.
Well, the aquifer is the water on the Western High Plains. That's the sole source of water in most places there. All of the streams and rivers are fed by the Ogallala Aquifer. So those streams and rivers are drying up now because we've been irrigating at such high rates out of the aquifer now ever since the 1940s in North Texas and since the 1960s where I come from in western Kansas. It runs all the way from southern South Dakota to North Texas. It underlies 174,000 square miles of the western Great Plains. And it is essential to the economy and to life there. It didn't used to be so centrally essential, though. We used to be dryland farmers, meaning that we were able to preserve the moisture in our soil. The historian Walter Prescott Webb calls dryland farming the science of farming where rainfall is deficient. Where I come from, we only had 17 inches of rainfall a year. But we had gotten that science and that art down. We knew how to grow crops, and we were actually prosperous farmers. It's just that when irrigation came along, the temptation to go that route was strong because we knew we could triple our yields with that extra water.
Now let's take a step back, and why don't you tell us your story without giving too much away about the Ogallala Road.
Okay, well, like I said, I grew up on that western Kansas farm. When I was 16, my parents decided to move to town. Like a lot of prosperous farmers were doing then, they traded some land that they owned for some land elsewhere in the county, and we moved into this little brick ranch-style house in town. It was a house that my parents had built. I didn't realize at the time that I had just undergone a huge change, a shock to my identity. The people my ancestors on both sides of my family had probably never done anything but farm. And all of a sudden, I was living what was essentially a town or even a suburban lifestyle. My dad at this point started commuting to the farm, whereas before we used to all have, our lives were all integrated with the livestock we were raising, the many different kinds of domesticated animals, both for profit and for pleasure, all sorts of wild animals that we tamed. It was a very sensory existence, a very gritty, down to the earth existence. We were growing most of our own vegetables and that sort of thing. My mother was canning.
How many generations of your family lived
in
this area?
Well, we had moved onto that particular farm. My grandfather had and his wife and children had moved onto that farm in 1906.
So before the Dust Bowl.
Right. And through the Dust Bowl, through the lessons learned in the Dust Bowl, we learned to farm more sustainably as dryland farmers. When I was 18, I decided that Kansas was boring. It was 1967, and I left. I went to San Francisco and began a whole life in this area, and that really changed me a lot. I think it gave me a new way of looking at our relationship to the land because I met a lot of people who believed in the value of growing your own food. There was a big back-to-the-land movement and so on. And after the city kind of wore off on me, after about 8 years or so, I started going camping in the Sierra Nevada and the desert, the Mojave Desert, and I just fell in love with those wide open spaces again, being able to see far, having a dry climate where the sun shined almost perennially. And I got so enamored of the desert that I actually moved there and lived in a little rock cabin out in the middle of the Mojave Desert wilderness. And I was riding high out there, and I was doing a lot of things that I was taught that only boys could do in my childhood, like fix my own truck when it spun a rod bearing and building my own outhouse with a hammer saw and nails and so on. And before you know it, I had made a very serious marital mistake, and I wound up broken pregnant back home in western Kansas. This was the 1980s. And I was shocked to discover how much farming had changed in my absence. We now were irrigating. I became one of my father's floodmen, so to speak. I became one of his hired people. You know, they were always hired men before, but I was a hired woman, daughter. And before I knew it, he was looking to me as the possible successor because my two brothers had turned down the opportunity to farm. So it was an elevation in status for a farm daughter, but it was difficult for me because of the environmental harms I saw that were being done through chemical farming and irrigating out of the aquifer.
They were hiding behind hay bales. They were planting in the full moon. They had given all they had for something new. But the light of day was on them. They could see the thrashers coming, and the water shone like diamonds in the dew. And I was just getting up, hit the road before it's light, trying to catch an hour on the sun. When I saw those thrashers rolling by, looking more than two lanes wide, I was feeling like my day had just begun.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to the author of Ogallala Road, Julene Baer. So in terms of policy, what can the federal government do in your eyes to save this region?
Well, right now the government is subsidizing corn, for instance, and soybeans. Both require a lot of irrigation water. Corn requires anywhere from 14 to 20 inches of water each year, yet we have the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change telling us that we need to preserve our aquifers and use that water to augment the crops that have grown in those regions traditionally without irrigation, but which are going to now need irrigation because we're going to have longer droughts and more intense heat. What we're headed for on the plains is a crash landing, and what I'm arguing for is a soft landing. A lot of farmers have already had a crash landing because they've already run out of water. almost all the rest of them are destined to run out of water unless the government changes this farm program policy. It also has an ethanol policy. Right now, 40% of the nation's corn crop goes to ethanol, and that's all because the federal government requires that increasing amounts of ethanol be mixed with our gasoline each year. So we need to reverse that policy. Everyone knows now that ethanol is not the big boon to the environment that we thought it would be. It takes almost as much fossil fuel to make a gallon of ethanol as you get. So if we reverse the ethanol policy and if we stop subsidizing crops that are not suited for the region, but instead subsidize a return to dryland agriculture and a return to grazing on the plains, we can have a soft landing rather than a crash landing.
And how do you see the Keystone XL pipeline, which has been in the balance for God knows how long now, if it does get built, how do you see it affecting that region?
If the pipeline still goes in across the eastern part of the Sandhills, as many people expect it would, a break in that pipeline, which is almost certain to happen based on other history with other pipelines, is going to cause pollution in that immediate area that would be very dire. It'd be very bad because the Sandhills are sandy, and sand water percolates through sand much more quickly than through other soils. And so any chemical spill there is going to trickle down very quickly into the water beneath the ground, which is much closer to the surface there. And it's going to go into the streams and rivers in that area. It's not going to pollute the entire aquifer because the aquifer is not a giant lake underground where you drop poison in one end, it's going to show up on the other end. The lateral travel is very slow, especially going west because that's uphill. The real pollution problem we have in the greater region is from non-point source agricultural pollution from the herbicides and nitrate fertilizers that are being used. But it still would be very serious. The pipeline shouldn't be built for a number of reasons, and this is just one of them.
We often hit upon agricultural issues around monocultural growing. We talk about how it relates to our diet and the problems with the industrial food complex and how we're just growing corn and soybeans and nothing else in certain areas. But how have you seen monocultural agriculture affecting relationships?
In my childhood, we had a more integrated lifestyle with the land, and there was a community on the land. We had many neighbors. Now, people always lived pretty far apart there. You needed to own quite a lot of land in order to make a living. Our nearest neighbors by road were 2 miles away, but there, every 2 miles or every mile and a half, there would be a farmstead and there would be a family. My parents would get together with their neighbors and play pitch. There was a 4-H club in the vicinity. There was a one-room school that I attended for a little while, and my brothers attended for longer because they're older than I. So we had a neighborhood. Now, if you go out there now, what you will discover is that the farms have gotten larger by many times. And if you go to a community function, you will find that, first of all, none happen, to my knowledge, out in the country, but in town. For instance, if you go to the county fair, it's a very dismal affair now. We had this big building in which the booths were set up by the various ladies' clubs and the 4-H clubs and so on, and there would always be many people milling about, and now all you hear is the organ music, which is still going on. There's always someone playing an organ, but it echoes throughout this building because so few people are in attendance.
She's the author of The Ogallala Road, A Memoir of Love and Reckoning, Julene Bear. Julene, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Fela Kuti, James Taylor, and Neil Young. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidioedu.org.
check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.